Reading from the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Volume 1, Chapter 5, Text 8. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Yo Brahma Rudradi Samadhi Durlabo Vidokti Tatparya Vishesha Gochara Sriman Nishinha Kila Vamanascha Shiragavendropi Yad Amsarupa. Bring that over here too. For Brahma, Rudra, and other demigods, he is difficult to realize even in advanced meditation. He can be known through the words of the Vedas only when one understands their special purport. Sriman Nrisimhadev, Sri Vamana, and Sri Raghavendra are his plenary expansions. Commentary. The supremely charming transcendental person, Sri Krishna, is difficult to understand. Great demigods may know his supremacy theoretically, but they cannot begin to taste Krishna praying. All Vedic texts are ultimately descriptions of Sri Krishna, yet his all-attractive charm is not obvious in the literal meaning of the Vedic mantras, nor in their ritualistic explanations. One must discover the secret purport of the Vedas, which is possible only by the mercy of Sri Krishna's pure devotees. Jnanis follow the process of anta nirasana, negating all inessential concepts, to find the supreme gradually in his impersonal feature. What are you doing there? Just bring the whole thing over here, okay? But to obtain a more confidential understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this neti-neti method is inadequate. Om Jnanati Marandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Daksur and Mulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sapadantikam Vansha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasude Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare. Greetings from Sayreville, New Jersey, at the CC Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Kishore Keshava Priya Temple. We had a wonderful program yesterday. It was about, I don't know, how many people, Galopa? 50, 60. And the nice thing is that by Prabhupada's mercy, Krishna consciousness is spreading. So there was another program in the congregation. Some Indian was installing their deities. So it was a full other program. We still have 56 people. All the Westerners were not just some of them, but from all over. Nice, Aryashra there. Yogi spoke on his relationship with the Holy Name. I spoke on the disappearance of Rupa Goswami. And there were five or six new people kind of coming around, established people, you know, who just relish seeing the practical application of Krishna consciousness, people like them executing spiritual life within their homes. It was very, very attractive. And a minimum 15 preparation of Ekadasi feast. And even the new people, they knew, they brought different things that were appropriate, so it was nice. And in that regard, I said, like this year, I'm going to have Janmashtami upstate where I live. And the reason is because there are people that are becoming interested, that you know, they need to be serviced in their spiritual life. And then I was down at Newburgh, where the Raval family is, and I introduced them to Shamdas, who's a Vallabha Vaishnava, but a Westerner. And they invited him over just for an evening. I think it was like Friday night, you know, and there were 30 or so people there. And the nice mix, there were these very nice, interesting, you know, Shamdas is very nice Vaishnava, and he does kind of classical singing. Most of it's talking, and he's explaining Krishna's pastimes at different times of the day, and what are the different songs that you'll sing at this appropriate time. And then, because he speaks Gujarati, he was telling Gujarati jokes. But what he didn't realize is that there were the people that were sitting in front of him, right, that were just relishing every word, you know, and laughing at him, and just so moved by the whole thing. They were Spanish people that were the patients of Dr. Raval. So I was showing him that he was giving them Gujarati, and but they loved it. So you see how this process of you know, the heart, bhakti, is what people want. People don't want just exercise, you know, and you know, they really want, they change their hearts. That's spiritual life. Make your heart more loving and selfless. And you can see how it's just so universal. And I saw these Spanish people, they came and they just loved the whole thing. I mean, you can see them, that such a deep connection. And also, about seven or eight people came from the Anand Ashram. And the Anand Ashram is 15 minutes away, and that's, of course, where Prabhupada went with Dr. Mishra. And, you know, it's almost like the particles of dust from Prabhupada's lotus feet are still, because one of the main people there has become a really integrated with the Vaishnav community. And it came over, you know, seven or eight people, and it was just a wonderful program. And then we all, at 9 o'clock at night, took special Gujarati prasadam. So it's just so. My realization is that prativitti achiyati nagarati gram, that this process of kirtan, which is so universal and so acceptable, is what people are thirsting for, bhakti and devotion. And devotion is expressed in glorification. The level of your devotion is the level that you like to talk about God. And Yajna's class, which was very nice, his theme was just a simple recommendation, you know, talk about the holy name with other people. Just talk about the holy name. Talk about, you know, that are interested, you know, your peers. Talk about chanting and kirtan. And it was so nice because that's exactly what happened. We just all started talking about kirtan together. So it was a very practical presentation of Krishna consciousness, because people got involved and were just, you know, explaining their relationship with the holy name, their struggles with the holy name. But that's what a spiritual society is. A spiritual society is a society where people, you know, what your society is what you talk about. You can name a society any particular external designation, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, But what your society is what you talk about. And if you're talking about politics, you're a political society, whatever name you put it. And you're not, it's not spiritual. And if you speak about God and glorifying the devotees and exchanging with each other, that's a spiritual society. One time, Garuda was giving, a distinguished professor came to Harvard, and he made a presentation that there's no such thing as a Vaishnav society in the Vedas or something. He gave some point like that, and Garuda wanted to kind of clear that up for the public, but not insult the professor. You have to be very careful, distinguished professor. And he said, well, how do you interpret Bhagavad Gita? I forgot what number it is, 10, one of the Chatur Shlokis verse, Machita Makata Pranat Bodhiyantas Parasva. What do the devotees do? They converse and enlighten one another. And that's the symptom of bhakti. If you're attached to Krishna, you like to read about Krishna, you like to talk about Krishna, and that's what we see in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Everyone loves to talk about the devotees. No one likes to talk about themselves. And that's another indication of your level of spiritual realization. How much are you interested in putting yourself in the center and therefore talking about yourself, and how much are you interested in putting God and God, of course, Rupa Goswami says God means his differentiated parts and parcels, which includes the devotee. How much are you interested in speaking about them? And this is the dynamic of Brihad Bhagavatamrita that indicates what bhakti is. The bhakta never wants to put himself in the center. He's always moving as the object of someone else's desires or service. And even we see with Srila Prabhupada, and I think, I can't say it's exclusive, but it's not exclusive, but it's rare, that as a spiritual leader from India that came to the West, Prabhupada did not put himself in the center of his movement. But because he did, he put Krishna in the center. And because he put Krishna in the center, we put Prabhupada in the center. Prabhupada didn't put himself in the center. And I always read, the thing that really struck me in this is that when I traveled in South India in 1976, I took a bus tour. It was super ecstatic, you know, experience going to temples and doing Harinam and distributing books and, you know. But when we went there, everyone would say, we heard of your Achyutananda Swami. Now, Achyutananda Swami is a brilliant, he was only 22 years old, but he spoke Bengali, he was incredible. So he was presenting Krishna, and he became in the center there. And that was Prabhupada's glory too. He could empower people, even young people, and he wouldn't mind. He wouldn't mind that Achyutananda people. We heard you're Achyutananda Swami because he was able to communicate. So here in this story, we're up to the part where Hanuman recommended the Pandavas as something higher. To Narada, he said, go, and then finally convinced him. A very moving, impassioned plea about the glories of the Pandavas. And then we'll see this, that Narada is running to them. Because where a devotee is glorifying Krishna, Krishna is there. The devotee is putting Krishna in the center. You want Krishna, you have to go to the devotee. That's the key instruction. In the Uddhava Gita, when Krishna says, what is the Parama Guhyam? He says, okay, Uddhava, you want to hear what is the Parama Guhyam? You want to hear what is the topmost secret? And then he says, not by mantras, not by fast, not by this, not by that. And then he says, it's by the service to the devotees that you can actually attain me. And because you go to the devotee, then Krishna is focus. And sometimes in the Bhagavatam, I forgot the section, but it marked me, where it was a point where clearly one of the speakers was going to say, and now we will discuss Krishna. And then the next verse, he begins discussing the devotee, because that's the devotee's vision. He's focused on Krishna. And even, what is Guru? What is Guru? He's someone who's looking at Krishna. He's looking up to Krishna, and he sees himself as the object of Krishna's desires. He's not looking down at other people and thinking that I am the object, that they are the object of my desires. He's looking up, and because he's looking up, then other people look up to him. Because his view is focused on Krishna, just like the mass, the front head of the back to God, you have Prabhupada looking at Krishna. So we go to Prabhupada, and we're going to look where he looks. We're going to get Krishna, because that's his conception. His conception primarily is I am the object of God's service. I am the disciple. I'm disciple of my guru, and because he's disciple then he becomes guru. So it's no surprise in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita that this type of consciousness of being servant, of being the object of God's desires, whatever God wants, kinkari, a name for gopi, kinkari. What you want, I will do, that consciousness. So here we've come to the point where Narada is running because he has taste. You run towards your tastes. And when you're a devotee of Narada's level, that's all your consciousness is. It's a taste for Krishna. It's pervaded. You're chanting and hearing, and you develop devotion, and that is your attraction, and that's all that's in your consciousness, that I want to serve Krishna. It's your addiction. And a person moves spontaneously towards their addiction. So they're addicted to Krishna, and they're addicted to Krishna's devotees. And they want, and Narada is searching for the person who has is the top recipient of God's mercy. Because what is that? It's that love of Godhead. And if you want to get love of Godhead, you have to go to the devotee. That's why we worship Govardhan, because he's Hari Dasa Varya. That's why when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the God wanted to taste the love of his own devotee, so he took birth as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is looking to get love of Godhead, because love of God is in the heart of the devotee. God is the object of that love. You want love, you got to go to the devotee. So even God, to get love of Godhead, had to go to the devotee who had it. And he didn't manifest love of Godhead until he met Ishvara Puri, his spiritual master. And then when he wanted to nourish it further, he took instructions from Ramananda Roy. So this is one of the prime examples. You're a devotee, you're running for sadhu sangha. You're running for sadhu sangha. And so now he finds the person that Hanuman has glorified, the Pandavas, and specifically Yudhisthira. And he finds Yudhisthira scheming to get Krishna. We remember that. Well, you know, maybe we can fake a calamity, beg, borrow, or steal. That's called greed, is spiritual greed. They want Krishna. What will we do? We don't care. We just want Krishna. So maybe we can have some calamity. Maybe he'll come back. But then when they see Narada, they stop. And they begin to, they want to worship Narada. Now again, Narada is the devotee. So he doesn't want to be the object of worship. He wants to be the object of a servant of someone. He doesn't want to be the object of worship. He doesn't want to be in that center, so he seizes and grabs the items He wants to worship the Pandavas. This is a spiritual competition. I saw that a very interesting one time. I saw it in two ways. One time, I was visiting Narayan Marj, and Narayan Marj, you know, when you're an acharya and you're a guru, sometimes you can become, I can't say it lonely, but, you know, you're surrounded, everyone's worshiping you. We're the friends. And they have their own institution. And specifically, he was in Bengali. He had one friend named Puri Marj who was Punjabi, he's from North India also. And one time I went there and that person came in and he went to touch Narayan Marj's feet and Narayan Marj went to touch his feet, and then these old men are wrestling. And it's the same kind of spiritual wrestling. Not that, you know, you want to serve someone, someone wants to serve you. It's like a feast. There should be a fight for who serves out, not a fight for who gets the first seat. There should be a fight. And you see that in the culture of Indian culture. When you go to nice class Indians' homes, they're fighting for the service. That's the culture, not to be served. And I also saw that once when in Vrindavan, I think when Malati met Jamuna after many, many years, the same thing. They each went for each other's feet, and it looked like a wrestling match between these older ladies. Because they want to serve, and that's what a Vaishnav is. He's looking to put himself out of the center, and he's looking to put himself as the object of service for God and God's devotees. So then Narada naturally, when he sees the items of worship, then bhakti comes out, and he glorifies, and he enhances it with music. That's why Krishna, one of Krishna's qualities is that he plays the flute. One of his four main unique qualities, his prema madhurya, the different loving relationships he had, the lila madhurya, the activities in those relationships, the rupa madhurya, the exquisite beauty of the absolute reality, when the absolute reality opens his heart fully in love. And Venu Madhurya, the flute playing, because when the love is expressed intimately and openly, when you don't have to check the love by your position, fearing that people will, it will not be appropriate for you to be spontaneous because people who need to respect you will lose that respect. The judge, he sits very, very formally. The father with his child, he's very, very formally, because the child needs to be respectful for that own child's development of character and love. So it has to be checked. So God also has to take om padam padam padam. So he has to take that position because that's most people's relationship. But Krishna is revealing himself fully, intimately, not checked by any Aishwarya or position. And when you do that, you can reveal your heart in jazz, in music. You can reveal your heart. That's a Krishna unique. We can't imagine Narayan dancing around playing the flute. We can't imagine even Ramachandra in the kingdom with a saxophone. But Krishna, we can imagine. And he's so sweet and he's so charming. So Narada sings the glories, and then, this is the previous verse, and then we're going to get to some questions that people asked from the previous class. Then Narada begins to tell of Krishna's special appreciation for the Pandavas. But before he's going to tell about Krishna's special appreciation for the Pandavas, because it's really about the Pandavas. So, but one thing about the Pandavas, their main glorification is Krishna's special appreciation of them. That's their main. So therefore, he has to say, who is Krishna? You really want to glorify the Pandavas, you have to say, who is Krishna? And this is the Madhurya Bhagavan. This is the sweet, loving God. This is God when he's revealing his heart fully. So he's going to explain and glorify Krishna, but first he says to them, you're the most fortunate. Why? A very significant word is mentioned here. It's Ukti Kanta. He's subordinate to his pure devotees. And therefore, however he's being glorified as the spiritual master, your blood, your maternal, your messenger, your order carrier, your charioteer, your dearest friend, they have one commonality. And what is Krishna? Krishna is subordinate to the love of his devotees. And that's the glory of Krishna. And there's no restriction. There's no restriction. I can't be subordinate to your love because of my position. That's Krishna. And that's why in the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, I mentioned it, it's very, very significant. The two main Vaishnava scriptures, basically, the one where Krishna is talking and the one that's where Krishna is glorified, in both those scriptures, the first time we see Krishna is on the chariot as the driver. This is because this is his quality. He's Bhaktivatsala, he's subordinate. So before we go on to today's verse, which I'm and a few verses, there were some questions left over by yesterday's last week's discussion. Mahamuni, you can bring up those questions.
Maharaj?
Yeah.
Do you hear me all right?
I can.
Okay. If I remember the question last week, and Johnny Kai wrote me and had similar concerns and maybe some other ones he'll bring up.
Well, this is a devastating opposition now. You're bad enough, Mahamuni. Now you're consulting my lawyer. Okay, go ahead.
The basic concern was that his last verse was about Lord Ramachandra and banishing Sita, and that's that whole discussion. And so often there's like a moral, there's a lesson we take from this, and that's something, I think you yourself said something like, you know, a good leader has to be willing to make sacrifices for the good of the people or something like that, or to set an example, to be above suspicion.
Right.
And I think the problem that a lot of us run into is that if we use Lord Ram's decision as an example, well, there's a lot of other lessons that you'd have to learn from it too, and one of them is mere village hearsay is enough to severely hurt, apparently at least, a chaste and loving wife. You know, you can just cast her off because people suspect she might be unchaste, and that would seem kind of really strange. It would seem like an immoral principle.
Right.
If you know, so that was the kind of problem we ran into, I thought. And
okay.
So maybe my question is, do you think it's best in some cases just to say, hey, this is Leela, and we're not in a position to draw any moral from it? Because when you try to draw morals from it, you end up choosing things selectively in a way that ignores some of the important features of the situation.
I think that would have been my answer ultimately if it couldn't be resolved. I think there has to be a point to, I want to get back to that, but I think there has to be a point when you know, first of all, you're studying the absolute truth. And although, you know, it's reasonable and accessible, I think that, you're when you deal with God, there's certain things that may be beyond your own understanding. In other words, and I don't think it's wrong sometimes when something is said in Prabhupada's vast recorded conversations and teachings, once you've experienced from that line of teaching authority in terms of the knowledge that's changed your life, the knowledge that's enlightened you, has given you a frame of reference, it's kind of, I give the example like a doctor who's just given you miracle cure, you know, so many things. You know, you develop a certain faith that in this person's authority. I don't think it's wrong to sometimes say, I don't understand it. I can't accept it. I'm not going to say it's wrong. I just can't accept it. Maybe I don't understand it. But the way I understand it now through my own frame of reference, it belies my common sense. It may even belie my morality. You know, I'm not going to question the authority. I'm not going to question. I've already have that faith and things. But that's, you know, I can't accept this personally myself. By God's grace, maybe one day I'll understand it. I think that's kind of a reasonable and healthy attitude to take. At the same time, you know, and therefore we've discussed this before when we had our Sherbourne gathering, sometimes. You know, and that type of culture is there even among the Acharyas. You know, sometimes they look in the commentaries or some, and they'll see something which they cannot accept as right, but it's an Acharya, right? But somehow or another, they can't really accept that statement as right. You know, or a grammatical understanding is right. And that what they say is, and Pradyumna told me this, out of respect, they never say, he's wrong, I'm right. They first go, Rishi Uchu. The Rishi said this. And then they state what they're going to state. So there is that type of culture that sometimes either, you know, different perspectives or different understandings or something, someone can't understand what's right. And, of course, I do really still think that you have to take into account what Borijan, you know, said. You know, he was trying to, you know, sometimes we, where, you know, he gave that example of Khrushchev's son, who became a professor in Brown University, I think, and then took American citizenship. And, you know, one of the reporters say, what did your father think about that? When I grew up, when I was young, it's probably before you, one of the most scariest scenes was when, you know, during the Cold War, when we had all these, you know, air raid drills and get under your desk because the world can be bomb type thing. And Nikita Khrushchev came to the UN assembly, right? And he took off his shoe and he banged it on the podium and he looked at the American ambassador and said, I will bury you. So here's Nikita Khrushchev's son taking he said, well, what do you think about this? He said, well, you can't, it's really hard to judge one era from another. So I still think that's kind of a valid type analysis into the whole thing, what that culture is. And of course, in terms of Ramachandra's example, it's not the example of just an ordinary family member staying above suspicion. You know, it's not just the ordinary family member. That's not the example. The example is of the leader. And you're not going to find a leader like that in the modern day. What it was to be a king and what the job of the king was. There's one purport with Prabhupada said, I think the king has to be a Mahabhagavat. You know, it's not to screw, you know, at least according to that paradigm, they would rule the kingdom in such an expert way. You know, there's no excessive heat, there was no excessive cold, you know. You know, you have the example of Arjuna, you know, the Brahmin, one of his sons was killed, he can come to the king. So at least in that ideal, the king had such an immense responsibility and job to keep the citizens happy. And, you know, and to do that, he'd have to be a Mahabhag. It had to be mystic power. Anybody who's taken any responsibility, keep a family together, what, keep a temple together? Satisfy everyone, how difficult that was. You know, so it was some type of whatever you accepted, a historical or real, it was an ideal. And part of the ideal, it was that king, no blemish, no apparent blemish, because that's what he needed to rule the kingdom at the level that he was expected to do so. So even if that doesn't exactly, you know, reconcile, you know, this particular dilemma, I think you have to look at it a little bit from that perspective, and of the duties of the king and the responsibility of the king. And then, of course, you get into more esoteric things of, the internal type stuff and things like that. And, you know, and I agree, you know, that the Leela could be where he called Sita in and said, Sita, I love you, but for the higher duty, you know, I must send you. It's breaking my heart. I must send you to the, but what can I do? We have to make a sacrifice for the citizens, you know. So that could have maybe reconciled it. So I don't think it's still perfectly reconciled, you know, but I do feel, I guess, coming to the points of separation in Leela and the structure of Shastra, and you know, the culture that the messages are given, because the Shastra is not just the stories, it's the message that's given. And you know some of the message of the ideal king to that degree, you know, maybe people at that time in that culture had a better frame of reference to get the message, you know, that's practically inaccessible to us today because of you know how things are changed. So what I'm saying is I can't reconcile it 100%. But I'm willing to explore that there's areas of culture and message and the nature of Shastra and how Shastra is interpreted that may have something of realization and understanding that we don't have yet to really make a closure on this, to use some modern terms. Mooney?
So that was, thank you, Maharaj. I think you gave a lot of perspectives on it.
Yeah, but keep on going.
Jonathai is there. I'm going to go, but if Jonathai is there, I invite you, Prabhu, to step in if you wanted to take up something. If I understand what you're saying, Maharaj, you said like two or three different, not contradictory, but two or three different approaches. One is that maybe the truth of it will be revealed in time, and therefore I can say that as far as I understand it now, I can't take this as a principle for me. But I'm open to the fact that my understanding is deeper.
Yeah, that I can't take this as a principle for me, but there's a principle there that I may understand in the future. Okay, that's fine.
And the other thing is that it's hard sometimes to understand culturally what the attitudes were then that might. And I think it's true that, like, I feel so screwed up by just being a member of a culture that promotes sense gratification above all else. It's hard for me to imagine a situation where a leader would think, because of a possible moral failing or at least a semblance of it, that his authority would be weakened. You know, I can't even conceive of that.
Right.
Now, you gave the example, though, of, you know, sometimes acharyas may say things that even other acharyas don't exactly agree with, but they're not going to explicitly say, here's what I find wrong about this. It's obvious that they don't agree.
Right.
Right? And that was supposed to be an example of what exactly? Was that the example of just the spirit one should have when running into things like this?
Yeah, that was the spirit. Yeah, I would say that was an example of the spirit. Rather than grab on it, I'll give you an example. I was once teaching this one person who, he was a university student studying for his PhD, and you know he wanted to write something about Krishna consciousness, and he came to learn for me Bhakti Sandarbha. So the person insisted on sitting on the same level because that's collegial, fine, no problem. And I was explaining something, right? And then he just said, I disagree. You know, it was like really strong. And I just said, okay, find yourself another teacher. there wasn't it worked out really good, honestly, because he was getting so much, you know, he was getting so much understanding. He just, but I think the point there was, is, you know, the attitude has to be, well, you know, maybe you didn't explain yourself clearly, or can you explain that again? You know, and maybe I didn't explain something clearly according to his frame of reference. Maybe it did appear as contradictory. But, you know, once you come to the, you're not an authority, okay, then, you know, what's the question of teaching, you know?
Yeah, and I also think that
It's the spirit. It's just like our discussions now. You know, you, Johnny Tai, anybody can ask anything. You know what I'm saying? And we can even debate, but it's in such the right spirit, you know, that it allows the dialogue to go on in a proper way, you know? So I think there's a certain cultural aspect that's important.
That makes sense. One thing, and I'm, honestly, this is a serious concern I have, and personally, is when a spiritual authority makes an argument where they, so in other words, when a spiritual authority, instead of just saying, this is my realization, take it or leave it, when they make an argument and they say certain things follow from other things, it seems to me they're now committing themselves to public norms of rationality.
Yeah.
And it's tough for me because sometimes I see spiritual authorities in our line make arguments that I just think are not good arguments.
Right.
And even right now, I'm doing a Sanskrit group with a couple of Vaishnava friends where we're studying a kind of famous argument that, for the life of me, it seems to be completely self-refuting.
Yeah.
This is by one of our greatest authorities.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like I'm willing to say I don't understand the context. But it's hard when someone says, here's the premises, here's the conclusion. It doesn't seem like it's just flowing from their spiritual realization anymore.
I can understand, but I would say the same criteria before saying they're wrong, right?
Yeah.
Keep in mind that, you know, a lot of times people speak in a particular frame of reference, so they make assumptions with what they say that, are not explicitly made. It's just like the Yoga Sutras. They're six words. But so much, you know, but Patanjali's, within those six words, he's making so many assumptions of what people understand that people don't understand now. So I think there's still a very, very, you know, humble and healthy way of looking at those things, you know, without contradicting your own kind of, you know, analysis and system. And I know, too, with Dr. Satyanarayan, and I thought this was exemplary, too, when he entered into, you know, some kind of academic discussion, you know what I'm saying? He didn't immediately attack. He just listened because he felt, I don't understand their system of language. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He said, I don't understand their system of language. So before he was going to, like, you know, argue with them, but it was their realm. They had a particular language. And he said before he learned that language, you know, himself, you know, he wasn't going to really deal with that. So that's one way. So in the same sense, you could apply it the other way. You know what I'm saying? Just like listen and saying, well, let me see if I can understand a little bit more about their language. You know, and see how these kind of conclusions come. You know, but I would like to discuss them with you personally, too, because, I want to see which things you actually would think are. I would be willing to discuss that with you personally some other time, you know, which things you think don't logically follow. And you have to be also, I'll be open, you have to also be open that there may be certain prejudice that you carry to the, you know, because what happens, too, I see that in all realms and all spheres, and then I'm going to go back to our just do a few verses to finish it up because I only have 10 minutes.
Sure.
You know, we carry a certain, a lot of assumptions. It's just natural to the table. What I'm saying is, and I've experienced this too, although people generally, I'm objective, et cetera, you know. But there's a lot of things that they're just accepting that just from hearing, from wherever they're hearing. I'm saying even in academia, even in spiritual, people are just accepting things. You know, it's just natural when you hear. You develop faith in a certain way. Anyway, we'll discuss that further, but I'm going to let me just go quickly to these verses. So what's happening is, we'll just do 10 more minutes, but I like these discussions. They're very, very enlivening.
Thanks.
Anything else, Mamoun, you just want to conclude?
Well, it would just bring up more discussion that I can shelve it.
Okay, well, I'll give you the last word.
You don't have to do that.
I'm reading minds now.
No, well, I mean, I think there's an option that you didn't mention that I think one option, I think, and frankly, sometimes I have to do this when I read when I see certain arguments Prabhupada made, is say that I accept the conclusion, and I understand that the conclusion is motivated by someone's deep realization and study of Shastra, but it may be that they choose whatever argument comes to mind to endorse it, but that argument I may not accept.
Okay,
I mean, I don't accept this. You know, we can discuss.
Yeah, I can understand. I mean, a world preacher trying to it's preaching, trying to convince people that it's the objective. You know, so it didn't work for you.
Well,
I'm not saying completely. I'm saying that particular argument, and sometimes where he's trying to convince people. And maybe the thread of logic didn't work for you who's studying that thing, but, you know, maybe if he knew you were in the audience and it was just you, he'd speak differently, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just going to bite my tongue. Thanks for everything, Mark.
Okay, bite your tongue, please. Okay, Nitai, get this talk.
I'm going to mute the phone.
Okay. Well, I can mute it myself if I didn't want to. Let me just finish so we get these verses. So Narada is glorifying it. So he's glorifying them as you know that this Krishna, it's, you know, that they have Krishna, but Krishna's not so easily known. And even in the Vedas, because the Brihad Bhagavatamrita is also for us. So one of the main points of the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, because it's representing the Bhagavatam, is the Brihad Bhagavatamrita wants to present Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because that's what bhakti is based on. Based on your faith. Aham sarvasya prabhavo matasarvam pavartate iti bhutva bhajanti mam buddha bhava. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, I am the source of the material and spiritual worlds. The wise who know this engage in my devotional service. Buddha bhava. You want to have bhava. You have to have some buddha. You have to have some intelligence, some understanding. So in Narada's speaking, because it's also Shastra, the significance of the Pandavas, their greatness, is that Krishna is with them and Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And he's the source of all other incarnations. But then if he's going to make that point, he has to also make it be aware of this point, that it's not also clear. It's not directly always clear. It's not always directly understood. Because Krishna is an intimate manifestation. And if you want to understand the intimacy of a person, you can't just read a history book. You can't just watch the news. You just can't read about him on the internet. You have to have a relationship with the person. And then we have a relationship with the person reveals. Therefore, it says, great demigods may know his supremacy theoretically, but they cannot begin to taste Krishna Prem. Because they don't have that level of relationship. Krishna is not their Ishtadev. It's another manifestation. And therefore, we can go, Vedaishya Sarvam Eva Vedyo Vedanta Vid Veda Vid Avajam. Of all the Vedas, I am to be known. Of all the Vedas, Krishna is to be known. But it's not so apparent, and there's many reasons. We don't have that much time to explain what the Vedas are and their strategy of the Vedas, because it's a strategy. And what they're concerned with is a particular result. And the Vedas is concerned with all humanity, and it wants to elevate all humanity. So it has to have different ways to do that. Even the Bhagavatam, I once asked a scholar, why is there a section calculation of time from the atoms?
He said, because the Bhagavatam is for everyone. It's for the history buffs. It's for the scientists. It's for the romantics. So it has everything in it. So to speak of the Vedas. And this understanding is very, very confidential. So it requires Krishna, even though the Vedas are there, you want to understand them. Yasya deve para bhaktir tata deve tata guru. One who has implicit faith in the spiritual master, the supreme, the imports of the Vedas are revealed. It's a living text. And therefore, to understand it, you got to get the mercy. And just analysis doesn't come to the conclusion. And the classic example is that Prabhupada used to tell of a person is on an island and there's no sweets on the island. There's only pungent, bitter, salty, butter hot, bitter, pungent, salty, hot, and sour. There's no other taste. But so he goes off the island, and then he gets some Son Papri, some Alpurs, some Keshi Das Rasgullas from Calcutta that the Queen of England used to fly to London, that kind of stuff. There's a place in London where they make Rasgullas where they only cook on neem wood because it's so subtle that the fuel affects the flavor. I'm an expert on sweets. And so when he comes back and tries to explain to the people what it is, they can only explain what it's not. So this nati-nati, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, which is the process of jnana, can't tell you what it is. So, and then it says the Vaishnavas adore the Supreme Lord in various aspects of his personality. You have a favorite form. It's called an Ishtadev, and they're wonderful. Lord Nrisimha, frightening and prone to anger. And his devotees, they remember how he cared for Prahlad and protected him. And Lord Vamanadev, so beautiful, a dwarf, and he covered the universe with three. So there's countless, and Ramachandra, here it is, remembering the example of the perfect monarch who abused his wife. No, I'm just joking. And but the attraction is a reflection of Krishna's supreme attractiveness, because Krishna is God at home, relaxed, full revelation, so beautifully. So that's what he's saying. That Supreme Lord, that's the Supreme Lord that the Pandavas had a relationship with. Okay, we can stop here for today. We did get to explain one verse. We got to have a review, and we also got to just intellectually, which was fun. And try to Shastra Vichar. Whenever I'm with Pradyumna, my godbrother, he said, "Okay, let's discuss Shastra Vichar. Look at it from different angles." He even quoted to me one verse. This is a little bit different, that we advance by Sadhu Sarg. But this is a little bit different. He says, Sarg means friction. So it means when you're with a very, very advanced soul, there's friction because their world is service and your world is sense gratification. And never the twain will meet or something. Okay, anybody else have a question?
I do, Maharaj.
Who's this?
Lakshmi Nrisimha.
Hey, Lakshmi, Haribol, thank you. So nice to hear from you.
Nice to hear you. And Mahamuni.
Yeah.
You were one of the many things that you said. You were talking about how Prabhupada, and I was it rang a bell really loudly for me because I was also thinking about this, how Prabhupada never really promoted himself.
Yeah.
You know, he promoted the chanting of Hare Krishna and the process of bhakti.
Right.
And you were explaining, sounds like something from St. John Climacus about how the pure devotee is always looking up at and never sideways or down at others.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a very significant thing. And you were also saying how Prabhupada liked the fact that Achyutananda Maharaj was getting acclaim for his singing, and you know, so on one hand, that's the ideal that one. There's actually an article by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur where I think the title of the article is "The Highest Vaishnav Sees Himself as the Lowest of All."
Hmm.
And that's the title of his article. And you know, he goes on to make all those points. But on the other hand, if one is in, and I think we've seen this historically in Krishna, in our ISKCON society,
yes.
Krishna consciousness,
yes.
If one is not on that level, but one is placing oneself in a position, you know, always speaking or always leading kirtan and always placing oneself, you know, with, I think, a good intent in the limelight, there's an extraordinary danger of, you know, especially if we're still on the platform of anishtita bhakti, of that taranga rangini, you know, where Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur describes how Krishna is all attractive and therefore his devotee is attractive. But on that level of, if we're not on the nishtha platform, the steady platform of devotional service, the one of the stages of anishtita is, you know, attachment to the acclaim that we receive, the wealth, the adoration, distinction, actually looking for it. And even maybe it's so insidious that that becomes a motivation for, you know, doing what we're doing, you know, whether it be as a kirtan leader or as a speaker of Bhagavatam or whatever the case may be.
Mm.
So it seems that there is that that really dangerous area. I mean, we know that we should be enthusiastically and aggressively, you know, presenting the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. But in that anishtita level, there is this extreme danger of taranga rangini and all the other aspects of anishtita bhakti. So what recommendations do you make? I mean, especially now, I see so many of the young generation, they're just out there doing kirtan like crazy all over the planet, you know, and it's so enlivening to me. But I'm, you know, my mind always goes to, you know, the dangers in the road, and you know, I don't want to be a naysayer or what advice do you give to someone?
I just to confirm what you said in one thing. Yeah, a very nice disciple is a very good kirtaneer named Akinchana Krishnadas.
Oh yeah, I know him.
And Jamuna, he went up to Sharanagati, and Jamuna really liked his kirtan. You know, then he went to visit her in Vrindavan when she visited. And the first thing she looked at him and said, she said to him, and just it's so nice. She says, you know, don't be an entertainer or something. You know.
Right.
Be a servant of the holy name. And I have to say with these youth, because I'm doing this book and we're interviewing a lot of them, they somehow or other, you know, from good association, have very, very strong culture and realizations about being a servant of the kirtan. You know, naturally, there's always going to be a danger on the front lines. But I have to say, in relationship to them, I'm very impressed that they have that. And I would say in terms of people, let's say the real danger, because they're young, they may have gurus, they may have seniors, you know, someone could always say something to them. But, you know, people who are like the top, you know, the eldest generation, I think the real, real key is keeping association with peers, you know, and having sufficient association on that level, because of, you know, and I, you know, one time there was a discussion I remember in Govardhan with Borijan and some other people, and said, you know, well, what do we do now? You know, we have these kind of services, and but we don't have like Prabhupada to, one to kind of worship and get that association with, and the conclusion is, you know, the collegial dealings with God brothers, one, will reveal that level of absolute truth, which I think you've experienced when you get together with God brothers who can share their hearts. And I think it could also keep people in check. And I think that's the danger, when people isolate themselves, you know, and then there is a great danger. So I guess it's risk doesn't negate the activity if some good result can be there. But I think, one, I would say there is a danger. There is a risk. There's also a benefit from, you know, preaching and taking a prominent role. And one has to have that opportunity to... I'll give you an example, just in myself, is this Tuesday I'm probably going to go to Philadelphia because Jayed Waitamarge is speaking, you know. And he always comes to my programs. And he always just sits and listens, you know. You know, and I thought it's just so nice that I'm going to go to a program, you know, I'm going to sit and listen, you know. And I'm looking forward to it so much, you know. So I think maybe that's a recommendation. We, you know, people who are prominent preachers, they have to go in situations where, you know, and Radhanath Swami spoke up there, you know, I was in the audience. You know, and, you know, because he was the preacher, things were moving around him in a very nice way. And I was happy to be part of that. Lakshmi, maybe you can just share some realization, and then, because I'm sure you thought about this.
Well, I just kind of want to recap what you said so I'm clear, because, you know, I think a lot of the things that you've said. And I always think of things in terms of symptoms. I don't know, maybe I was a doctor in my last life or something.
You definitely were, an editor or a doctor.
Yeah, something. I always think of things in terms of symptoms, and a couple of things that you just mentioned that I think I also thought about in terms of symptoms, because I kind of agree with you. With the youth, they do have, you know, in terms of their approach to the holy name, they really have imbibed the quality of being servants of the holy name, and I think that's where they get their empowerment and their enthusiasm. I probably think more in terms of my own generation when I talk of that. But symptom one, I think that you mentioned, was the fact that it's a good sign if someone is seeking out the association of their peers. And I don't mean just like being, you know, shoulder to shoulder on a dais or something like that, but that they actually have an interest in attending others' classes rather than always have to be the top of the bill.
Yeah.
I think that's a great symptom of, you know, someone who, even though may oftentimes be in the limelight or the center stage, that they are recognizing the dangers and of that position, and, you know, they also Taranga Ragini, you know, actually expecting glorification, expecting dakshin, expecting this, expecting that. So
yeah.
I think that to me is like a very, very important symptom. And you know, I think another symptom, I don't know if you mentioned this or not, is a kind of a self-evaluation program where, you know, one actually, if they're introspective, they have developed a whole mechanism or method of self-evaluating. You know, what am I doing? How am I treating my God brothers? How am I thinking about my God brothers, or how am I thinking about the devotees? And, you know, like a whole list of guidelines that they can regularly apply to themselves, you know, because in Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said, amend thyself.
Mm.
And it looks, you know, when someone is expert in the philosophy and the nuances of the philosophy, if they somehow or another are capable of turning it to themselves in their own heart and becoming expert at identifying the weeds surrounding their own creeper rather than an expertise in developing a critical nature of others. And And I was giving a class once, and the point that I made, it seemed to ring loudly with the devotees, that actually, if you develop that habit, then the necessary intelligence to for selection purposes to distinguish certain symptoms in, because, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur does make the distinction about one of the five types of materialists is the hypocritically devout devotee. So, I mean, in various places, he does make mention of the fact that there are hypocritical devotees and devotees who are self-interested, etc. So I think also as Vaishnavas, we have to be selective. But if the method is, I examine my own heart, and as a result of that, by the blessing of Guru and Vaishnav and Krishna, I am able to become a little purified from pride and egoistic thoughts, then necessary intelligence to distinguish between who is the pretender and who is the real devotee comes by the mercy of Krishna, and it's not for any self-aggrandizement, but it's for protection of one's creeper.
Hmm. So, I mean, just that last point is that if you can self-evaluate yourself, and it will give you not only the skills, but the reciprocation and realization to protect yourself in terms of your own association. In other words, you can understand yourself, you'll be able to understand others.
Yeah.
And reflect. Wow, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, because the purity that comes from that, it's all a matter of, you know, priority. If your priority is to find fault in others to raise yourself up to a higher level, then we know that's based on false ego. But if the priority is to understand my own heart, because I have, you know, minimally I have an obligation to my spiritual master to take this process seriously, if that's the priority and we look at things from that perspective first, then the kind of humility and purity that ensues, that the necessary things to look for, you know, in terms of being selective in association with various Vaishnavas, it's always that we should always respect Vaishnavas, but we also are given the right to be selective in who we want to associate with. But by developing that self-evaluation type of introspection, the purity comes in such a way that we can make a choice, not out of any motive other than to protect my own devotional creeper and you know, to advance Krishna consciously.
Well, thank you, really. I really appreciate these points. It's great. I'm just going to go on. Lakshmi, great. Thank you. Another, just a nice thing. You'll be pretty happy. This evening I'm doing the Ashbury Park Spiritual Ecstasy Festival. And yesterday at the park, like, you know, we had like 50 people and new people, but it was nice too. There was one guy, Brian, that came to Tuaco like 13 years ago, you know, and disappeared for, you know, so actually he came with Jeff and Allison, and when they joined the temple, he became isolated because he was a young kid, he couldn't get a ride. And then, you know, to see him back there, he was so happy, you know, he's wearing neck beads, one devotee was staying at his house, and I know, it was just nice, there's just a lot happening. Anyway, thanks so much, Lakshmi, that was great. I mean, it really helped make the, you know, class. Thank you. I'm so happy. Anybody else like to say hello before we go? Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Hello, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna, that was Ami, and who is this?
This is Rasigya.
Rasigya, Hare Krishna.
Yeah, this was so many wonderful points. And I just wanted to say one thing, if I can find
please
a way to express it. It was,
yeah,
back to the Sitaram thing.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time playing Sita.
Ah.
And different, you know, characters in that scene, but mostly Sita, and of course went through a lot of turmoil in regards to that very situation. And one thing I remember feeling is that I felt really bad that I had not listened to Lakshman when he told me, when he was specifically asked by Lord Ram to stay there and not leave me alone. And so I felt like I contributed so much to the situation by my desire and fear.
What you're doing is you're relating the part where Sita didn't follow Lakshman and kind of intimidated him.
She totally intimidated him to the point of suicide.
I mean,
it was really serious. Imagine saying, if you don't go and get him, I'm going to commit suicide. And the only reason you're staying here is because you want me.
You want, totally. I'm totally with you. I'm totally with you.
And so I felt really like I'd caused the whole thing in a way. And then when there was some criticism at the end, you know, when she goes into the fire, I thought, well, you know, when something like that happens, there's going to be people that think you should go into the fire, and there's going to be people that don't think you should go into the fire. And because Ram is the king, he has to satisfy everybody. And by the people that that wanted her to go in the fire, by her going in the fire, then afterwards they would probably feel horrible too. But that's what happens. Like even Prabhupada sometimes, somebody, leader would want to do something, and Prabhupada really didn't want it, but the leader wanted it. And sometimes I think that the leader allows certain things in order for some other realization to come. So it's not about right or wrong. It's just about how it is in this world.
You know, it's interesting, too. I think because, you know, you're an actress, and, you have to understand the part. I guess that's part of your training.
Yeah, and the whole everybody else's part as well.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I'm finding it fascinating. So you're almost like Sita saying, well, I guess this is because of my past mistake.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as an actress, or as the, you know, you're trying to get the emotions of the person.
I can really appreciate it. Anyway, that's
one
great.
Please. One more point that I've been thinking about since this discussion came up a couple of weeks ago, and that it is possible that it is actually Sita's choice to go to the forest. Before this was able to become a government issue, so to speak, in Ram's court, the gossip was there, and I'm sure that Sita heard the gossip before it ever became a government issue.
What was there?
Oh, we're getting interference now.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that perhaps the gossip was heard before it became a government issue, so to speak. And
you mean perhaps you think she heard the gossip?
Absolutely. The women, you know. Absolutely. She had her grapevine.
Well,
and that she knew what was coming. And that she actually said, I'm going. And that his way of dealing with it, okay, fine, you have already made up your mind, then go. Also sometimes we don't get the whole character, you know, the whole complexity of a certain happening. We get sort of a skeleton idea, but we don't get a full-fledged, you know, like in the Gita, for instance, we don't get the full-fledged characters of all the participants in the battle. If you read the Mahabharata, then we get a much clearer picture of who these people actually were, these warriors. You know, we get a full appreciation of their of the complexity of their personality. And sometimes we don't get that. We have to read a whole lot more things in order to get a full picture of what was Sita's idea now. I have an idea that she also, there was so much intrigue in the palace before they left for the forest, and I'm sure there was more after they came back.
Okay.
You know,
well,
that's my idea.
Thank you, Amir. I think we'll have to just think about all this.
Yeah,
and
it's pure speculation on my part.
No. Thank you. Thank you, Amir. And yesterday's program was sponsored by Amir. in honor of her, I guess, ex-husband, but kind of her husband, and we had a feast in his honor, who she happened to be there when he left the body and was able to assist him. Even though he wasn't a devotee per se, at least a Krishna devotee, she was able to assist him to have an auspicious departure from this world. So in that regard, we also honored him yesterday. Anybody else like to say hello? Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, we'll end for today. Thank you all. It was great, everyone. Pancha Kalpa Tridisha. Pancha Kalpa Tridisha.